Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350 plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
What's back to my old introduction style, my podcast host who's out of ideas? I'm Robert Evans, host of Behind the Bastards, the podcast where we talk about terrible people. And more importantly, I completely botch the introduction every time. And after 100-some-odd podcasts, I shouldn't be doing that anymore. But I'm not a professional. I am a hack and a fraud. But you know who isn't a hack and a fraud? Shireen Lana Yunus! Airhorn.
I've never felt more like a hack and a fraud than I am when I'm on this podcast.
Well, why is that?
I don't think I'm smart enough for this. What? No, I am.
Well, the point of this podcast is nobody's very smart, or none of these people would be getting away with all the shit they get away with.
True. No, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me back. I'm excited to know what
fucker is out there
fucking up the world.
Well, Shireen, I'll tell you who we're talking about today.
Okay.
But I want to ask a question of you first.
Okay.
What in your mind qualifies someone as a ladies man?
A ladies man? Well, someone that's like a charismatic, smooth talker, you know? Maybe gets away with a lot of like things that a less capable person would get away with.
Yeah.
He's popular, but I don't know. Like, you know, like if someone's a creep and they're good looking, you give them a pass because they're good looking. Like, not like you, but like, yes. I'm just saying, like the general society. I kind of think of that as like a ladies' man. But also, you can be a good kind of ladies' man and be nice to ladies, and treat them well. Right?
It is a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've known some guys that I would describe as ladies men who were very respectful.
Yeah.
And I've known some guys who are ladies men who are like absolute sociopaths.
Right.
Like it's but it always is one of the two. They're either like the best person you know and they're just incredibly charming because they're really decent people, or they're utter like soulless monsters.
Yeah. I think there's definitely
a middle ground.
There's definitely a dichotomy there where there's like one side where they're like charismatic, the life of the party, everyone is like attracted to them like a magnet, and the other side where it's like a dark brooding, they just get all the girls because they're just like rude.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, today, Shireen, we are talking about the quintessential ladies' man, one of the men, in fact, for whom that term was coined.
Wow.
And the guy we're talking about today is also the inventor of the concept of fascism.
Oh! that's a nice little blend of attributes.
Yeah, this is a hell of a tale. So I'm curious for a woman's perspective on this guy's. I don't fully understand this guy's appeal, but it was undeniable, like in his lifetime. But I find him baffling. So maybe you can help me make sense of this.
I will try my best.
Have you ever heard of Gabrielle D'Annunzio?
Nope.
All right. Well, neither had I really until I started digging into him a little bit back. So he's not very well known today outside of Italy, but he is an important figure. So Gabrielle D'Annunzio was born on March 12th, 1863 in the city of Pescara, Italy. Now, the nation of Italy itself was only about 2 years old when he was born. Because it had just, you know, like after the Roman Empire fell, it had mostly been a collection of city-states and big chunks of it had been ruled by other countries and kingdoms and shit. So, like, Italy had just started being a thing, like, in the modern sense when this guy's born. And Pescara, his hometown, was a small coastal city buttressed by mountains and pine trees. It was not a particularly, like, hustle and bustle-y place. And Gabrielle's father, Francisco Paolo, was the mayor. Today, we'd probably consider Gabrielle's family to have been upper middle class. His dad was a small-time landowner and a wine merchant with a terrible habit of spending much more money than he could actually afford. So they made a good living, but they were always kind of like on the edge of their means. Now, as the biggest man in town, because Francisco Paolo was, you know, the mayor, he needed to be seen displaying conspicuous wealth. So some of Gabrielle's earliest memories during Carnival were of his father standing on the balcony and tossing gold and silver coins down into a crowd of partying poor people, which was like not just his dad did that. In any town, the guy who occupies his position, that's like a tradition.
Okay.
That's how you show off your largesse, right?
Okay. So he was like a good guy. He was perceived as...
No.
No?
Well, I mean, I think he was very popular in town. Yes, he was perceived as a good guy, but this was also like what you do if you're
okay.
the mayor.
Okay.
If you're the richest man in town, you throw money into crowds on Carnival. It's just what happens.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds
like
a fun time.
There's
worse traditions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I prefer other forms of income redistribution, but that one's
but
not
throwing
the worst.
Money at me, that can work, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. It's better than what we have now where they don't do that at all.
Yeah.
And just hoard it all. Yeah. So
I can imagine like a. If that happened now, it would be, like, very riotous. Like, just clamoring for that $1 or, like, whatever cent is on the ground. If you really let me, you know, because times are rough.
Times are rough. I do think if, like, I wonder, because, like, I think part of why so many rich people are against both Warren and Sanders, who both have wealth redistribution platforms, is that they while they're in favor of like charity and stuff is number one, they spend less money on charity, but number two, like then it's them, then everybody gets to see like, oh, this great rich person bought this hospital, as opposed to like, well, this guy paid his taxes,
right?
Like one of those feeds your ego more. Maybe for like, look, you have to give up X amount of money, but you can toss it into a crowd of partying people. Like let's compromise.
Yeah. That's a good question. I don't know.
Francisco Paolo, like, you know, Gabrielle's dad, he grows up like seeing him doing all this stuff. It's very ostentatious, and displays of wealth are a big part of his childhood.
Mm-hmm.
His dad also had a hobby of dyeing doves in a variety of colors using like new high tech dyes at the time and letting them fly around inside the house, which is weird.
That's an interesting hobby.
They didn't have TV or radio, so, you know...
They had to entertain themselves by...
Yeah, torturing animals is about all you got.
Wow. That's quite the activity.
I don't want to keep, like, leading back to my pro-dogfighting agenda, but, you know, in a time with less entertainment...
You have a pro-dogfighting agenda? I've been out of the loop. I'm
Some
sorry.
Dog fights,
oh,
Shireen.
Oh, okay.
Some dog... Legal dog... No, I'm
let's,
I'm
but, making let's
a
never
horrible,
talk about
horrible
this.
Joke. So as a young boy, Gabrielle was the beloved center of his family's world. He had a brother and three sisters, but Gabrielle's family immediately recognized that he was special and treated him that way. And generally, when we say someone was a child genius on this podcast, we're repeating the lies of a narcissist. This is not the case with Gabrielle.
Okay.
Basically, everyone who's ever covered this guy, ever written about him, agrees that he was, like, everyone kind of knew he was a genius from a very early age. His most prominent biographer, Lucy Hughes Hallett, absolutely despises him and thinks he was a monster, but repeatedly emphasizes that just everyone who knew him as a kid recognized that this kid's brilliant, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's not lying about that. Now, Gabrielle was a mama's boy, later writing of his mother that her glances made my heaven. He was surrounded by women from an early age, maids, sisters, and aunts, and his grandmother. He was the center of their world, and he in turn learned how to manipulate and to please women.
Ladies, his adoring man. Female.
Yeah, exactly. That is something like all the guys I know who I would describe that way. Most of them grew up with like either a single mom or like, but like usually they grew up raised primarily by women.
I think they definitely have to have a female influence so they can understand how a female brain can work. Not that it works so different, radically different, but it does in some certain like circumstances with like intimacy and bonding.
No, I mean, it's kind of like, it's just like you grow up like wanting, because they're like the center of your world, mm-hmm. like really wanting to please the women around you. And then as you go out into the world, that remains like one of the centers of your being.
Yeah.
And I do think that's, sorry.
No, go ahead. Sorry. I just keep saying yeah and agreeing, and then it sounds like I'm about to say something more, but I have nothing profound to say. But I will say that I think being raised around women and understanding women in the real world, that leads you to almost like speak their language, and you're able to like establish a bond with someone like immediately better than like someone else that's not like that doesn't have sisters, that wasn't raised by a single mom, because there's already like this understanding there. And I think that gets you in their bubble, you know. You break that barrier so much easier,
because if you're raised mostly around men like I was, you grow up starting every conversation with just a series of fist fights, and that only works in certain situations. It's very helpful at like the Taco Bell, but outside of that,
the Taco Bell, really, so you're gonna get into a fist fight at Taco Bell.
I can navigate a Taco Bell like nobody else. It's just a bunch of right crosses, but
good to know.
So Pescara, the city he was born in, is located in a region of Italy called the Abruzzi. And there was vanishing, and it was kind of like a rural area, so there was vanishingly little to do there outside of religion. And basically any monuments around him were either churches or these perilously carved caves that had once been occupied by monks and been turned into like sites of worship. Mm-hmm. And faith there was a mix of extremely strict Catholicism and ancient Italian pagan traditions like fortune telling, palm reading, and other manners of like what we'd call witchcraft. One of Gabrielle's earliest memories was being taken in by an aunt of his who was a nun, into a part of the convent where males were not allowed to go, and then breathlessly watching her perform like a pagan fortune-telling ritual. So he grows up both with this intense like ritualistic pagan influence in his life, and also with a lot of his earliest memories being, because he's seen as special, taken into places he's not allowed to be. Mm-hmm. Those are both kind of like, you can see like the kind of person that makes like this idea that like the rules don't apply to me, like I'm not bound by the same things as everyone else.
And then the world proves him right by letting him like go into places he's not allowed. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely proves him right.
Now,
Gabrielle was never religious and nursed all of his life a deep contempt for priests, but he also grew up with an abiding love of ritual and the trappings of faith, if not any actual like belief in faith. Mm-hmm. He would later write of himself, quote, "I come from an ancient breed. My ancestors were anchorites in the Maya. They flagellated themselves till the blood came. They throttled wolves. They stripped eagles of their feathers, and they scratched their seals on giant rocks with a nail Helen took from the cross." So,
damn.
A lot of pagan influence here, you could say. Now, Gabriel D'Annunzio was an infamous liar, but the books and stories he published later in his life give us deep insight into the sort of things he would have experienced as a boy in Pescara, because writers write what they know. So I'm going to quote now from the biography of Gabriel D'Annunzio, titled Gabriel D'Annunzio, Poet, Seducer, and Preacher of War, by Lucy Hughes Hallett. And this is a quote from that biography about one of his early books. Quote, "In D'Annunzio's first story, set in or around Pescara, he conjures up a place where the bustle of port and barracks and market are contrasted with the frustration of women confined to small dark rooms, who watch the life of the street through chinked shutters or small high windows. The church bell clangs out the hours. Priests pass in the streets carrying extreme unction to the dying. Young people, strictly segregated as a rule, furtively press up against each other in the merciful darkness when the church lamps are extinguished in Holy Week to mark Christ's passion. Funerals, the bier followed by a long lines of hooded mourners, their faces covered all by but a slit for the eyes, or processions of girls in sacrificial white on the way to their first communion, provide the town's main spectacles. Many of the stories D'Annunzio related about his childhood concerned dying animals. There was the death of his little Sardinian horse, a bay with a white muzzle named Aquilino, whom he would feed with apples and sugar lumps in the peace of the nighttime stable. There was the quail the farm manager gave him in a cage made of twigs. Half a century later, D'Annunzio could still recall how the tiny creature had dashed itself against its makeshift bars, gashing its head until the bone showed. On killing days, the howling of stuck pigs and their blood spurting into basins so appalled him that he would hide in a corner, face to the wall, his hand over his contorted mouth. Life scared me as though it stalked me with a pig-sticking knife in hand. After the massacre, he sobbed all night. So that's a little insight into his childhood.
Fuck.
He's not a bad writer.
No, he wrote that about himself.
So yeah, yeah, so like that included a lot of quotes from him. Yes, yeah.
He's called a poet and a seducer is what I remember from your description.
Yeah, that's the biography title. Yeah.
I mean, that's very poetic. That's a very graphic way to describe everything. The bone and the... Fuck. Jesus Christ. What an intense life.
One of the things Lucy Hughes Hallett, his biographer, emphasizes is that he was really... His writing had a real visceral quality, just in the way he described bodies and like his romance mm-hmm. books, and like in the way he like wrote about like it was. There's a lot of blood, a lot of like he was one of those like shove your hands into the meat kind of writers,
right?
Which is part of why he had such an impact on people. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Anyway, back to Gabriel. He'd almost been choked by his call while he was being born, and because people are dumb, this was the focus of much superstition. Babies born this way in Italy were believed to have the second sight, and the call itself was supposed to protect the person from drowning. Now, the call, if you aren't aware, is the amniotic membrane that surrounds a fetus. Gabriel's parents dried his and put it in a little silk bag, which they hung around his neck for his entire childhood. So that's cool.
That's so fascinating, because if he was already born with this idea that, like, this child is second sight, this child is special, like, how much of it is nature versus nurture? Like, how much of it was, like, I know I'm special because everyone's telling me I'm special? Yeah. And how much of it is, like, you have a genius brain and it just so happens that everyone already knew that about you? Like that's so fascinating. How much of it was him living to the standard that everyone had of him, and how much of it was just, like, actual intelligence? I don't know.
His whole story has convinced me that my idea towards how you should raise a child is correct, which is when they're five, you put them out in the woods with a knife and you leave them. And if they come back home, if they find their way back home, you know, then they get to continue to grow up. And if not, well, you know.
I don't mean this in a bad way, but I don't want you to have kids anytime soon.
I'm just gonna say, if someone had done that to Gabrielle, he's not gonna grow up thinking he's special, you know?
For sure.
You're out in the woods with all the other 5-year-olds, and you have to form your own society if you're gonna get back to your parents. And then,
I have a question.
And then you learn
Does he
humility.
Have siblings?
Yes.
And, like, they must have had an awful life. I mean, not awful, but they must have had very much, like, a complex about themselves with this, like, special prophet child around them all this time, right? Like,
I don't know much about how his siblings thought of him. He was very charming, and you do get the impression that everybody was kind of in love with him when he was
a little
kid.
So he got away with it. He got away with everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, his most significant childhood memory was of one of his sisters showing him a fake pearl, and he was so taken with the object that he immediately started climbing the nearest tree to steal an egg from a bird's nest, because kids are fucking stupid. Mm-hmm. His parents rescued him before he fell down and killed himself, and they freaked out about the whole ordeal. And I'm going to quote from his biography again. Mm-hmm. His parents were there, his mother trembling, his father pale and threatening to beat him. He was lifted back through the window and laid, faint and shaking, on a bed. In retrospect, he saw them, the mother, father, child, as a secular trinity. His aunts hung over him weeping, as the sorrowing Marys wept over the dead Christ. But the family's communion was interrupted. The crowd now gathered in the street, believing the child to be dead, began on the chilling ululations customary at funerals. Gabriel's father picked him up and carried him, limp and white-faced, back out onto the balcony. The keening turned to shouts of joys. Describing the incident in old age, D'Annunzio made of this, his first balcony appearance, a portent. He was marked out from childhood, so he asserted, for a public life. So this is his, like, defining childhood memory, is almost dying on a tree and, like, the whole town turning out because they hear his parents and aunts shouting. And yeah.
And this is he's recounting this from his memory. So
yes,
there's a
yes.
There's an element of, like, loftiness that's absolutely in this memory that is, he was a child. There's no way every time you remember something, it becomes distorted. So
yes,
by the time he's recounting this, I'm sure it's not 100% factual, But I will say that I went from like having this like Christ image of everyone like gathered around him and being sad to like the Lion King of like Simba being on like Pride Rock on this balcony, just like lifting up this child, being like, this will save us.
I think he sees himself a little bit that way. Yeah, he definitely sees himself as a Christ-like figure.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, he was absolutely a narcissist. Like, there's not a doubt in my mind that this guy was a narcissist.
The way he recounts his own memory is very telling of that.
Yeah. Now, his school reports from the time describe him as very unbelieving in God. And as a boy, his favorite books were Paradise Lost and Cain by Byron, both of which were epics about heroes who rebel against God. Mm-hmm. In school, he got in trouble for telling his teachers, who were priests, that if God existed, he was a villain or an imbecile who created mankind to amuse himself by watching us suffer, which is not an unreasonable theory.
No, I kind of feel the same way a lot of the time.
Yeah, I get on board with that
one.
I feel like if you're at all a thoughtful person, you at least consider that possibility at some point in your childhood. It's like, what the
400%.
Fuck is going on in this world?
I mean, like, when I was 12, I told my mom I didn't believe in God because I just, like, I thought he was so cruel and just amusing himself by making everyone suffer. And then she started crying, and I was like, oh, I'm too young to speak my mind. I should keep it to myself. But I will say that's a very normal thing for a child to think, especially if he's being raised by God-loving, God-fearing people. So,
I think even if you wind up being very religious, at some point, if you pay attention to the world, you have to wonder, is if there's like a space guy in charge of all this, is he a fucking lunatic?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is happening up there? Yeah. I think that's he's on the money with at least that. Line
I will
of
agree with this point so far. You got me there.
Yeah.
Okay. One now, for you.
Gabrielle grew up in an exciting time for Italy. Giuseppe Garibaldi had conquered Sicily in 1860 with just 1,000 men, defeating the vastly superior military of the Bourbon monarchy. King Victor Emmanuel had united Italy as a single polity for the first time since the fall of the Roman Empire. Nationalism was sweeping all throughout Europe in this period, but nowhere was it stronger than Italy. And nowhere in Italy was it stronger than in the heart of young Gabrielle D'Annunzio. So the idea of being Italian, very new at this point.
Okay.
For most of history, nobody would have cared. Like, nobody thought of themselves as Italian. You thought of yourself as, I'm a Venetian, you know, I'm a Roman, I'm a Florentian or Florentine, whatever the fuck they call people from Florence.
But there was this newfound, like, nationalism that was, like, very prideful.
Yes. And from an early age, he really identifies with this as an Italian. And he's kind of one of the very first like major Italian thinkers in the Italian peninsula to identify as an Italian.
Okay.
Now, when he was 11 years old, Gabrielle's parents sent him off to a boarding school, the Cisognini. Jesus. This is like supposed to be my ancestral tongue, and I don't know anything about it, so
really?
I apologize.
I did not know that
about
you.
Yeah, my whole family is very Italian. We came in like the 1890s on a boat to the U.S., but yeah, they come from like Transalpine Gaul, like the chunk of the Alps that's on the Italian side of the peninsula.
That's fascinating. Look at you now.
Yeah, look at me now. At the time, sending your kid off to this boarding school was like the thing to do for wealthy parents.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in modern terms, we would consider this schooling experience to be profoundly abusive. Mm. One of the school's rules was that new pupils could not return home, not for holidays, not for summer vacations, not for any reason, for their first 4 years.
Whoa.
So from age 11 to 15, Gabrielle is just in this school, totally isolated from this very loving family that he's grown up in. So he goes from this like very safe, nurturing place where he's like the center of the world.
Mm-hmm.
To a cold boarding school run by priests who show no warmth or emotion or compassion to any of their charges. Yeah, he describes the Cisognini in letters home as a prison. His only escape was a daily walk around the grounds. His letters home to his parents became almost fervidly loving and cloying, agonizing over bright memories of his childhood and obsessing over the pain of his absence. Lucy Hughes Hallett, Gabrielle's biographer, suspects that this environment caused him to grow a shell that was at least partly responsible for the fact that he grew up into the sociopath to ever-path socies.
Whoa. That is a great, that's a great line.
I guess
it must have been jarring to go to a place that you weren't like revered constantly.
Yeah. And I guess it kind of destroys my thesis that making children survive alone in the woods for months would stop them from becoming monsters.
Well, your theory is that you would do that at a young age before they had a chance to think that they were messiahs. But
You're right, Shireen. My theory is bulletproof. My theory of child
rearing. Your theory
rearing.
Is
Thank
not
bulletproof.
I won't say it's
it.
Bulletproof. I will say it's fascinating. And I will say to use a condom. But continue.
Now, at a certain point, Gabrielle seems to have replaced the affection he once expressed for his parents with a love of Italy. At age 13, after 2 years in the Sassognini, he wrote that he had two missions in life. Quote, to teach the people to love their country and to hate the enemies of Italy to the death. Now, I'm obviously not a child development expert, but this does not seem like healthy behavior to me. As a general rule, I think children shouldn't focus on hating the enemies of their country to the death. I feel like that's led people in bad directions.
Mm-hmm. That's how you make Gabriel's an army. Generational army.
Yes, that's how you make the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Gabriel's devotion to his nation was not, however, selfless. He seems to have been obsessed with Italy primarily as a vessel to express his own greatness. One of his school reports from the time notes, he is entirely dedicated to making a great name for himself. He signed one of his earliest photographs, a picture that he sent home to his parents, with "To Glory." So.
Whoa.
Yeah.
All right, Gabriel.
Now,
glory.
Yeah. Any other child probably would have been ribbed mercilessly for this kind of arrogance, but it must be said, Gabriel backed up his words with deeds. He learned to play the violin and the flute and to sing expertly. On holidays, he would translate ancient Greek literature into Italian. He wrote ceaselessly, and when study time ended every evening, he would collect the excess lamp oil from the other boys so he could stay up all night writing. He was always at the very top of his class, and at one point, he wrote home to his mother that he was angry he'd been allowed to skip a test because, quote, I am certain I would have taken the first place. At age 16, he could speak and write fluently in Italian, Greek, Latin, English, French, and Spanish.
Okay, so he's not... So my theory about nature and nurture, okay, there's definitely an element of him being intelligent. I won't deny that.
Yes, he's very smart.
Yeah, he's a smart kid, but it is a very interesting idea to... I don't know. Like, you can be smart and not a fucking lunatic.
Yes, and he definitely... I don't know, we'll tell you where this goes. But before we talk more about Gabriel D'Annunzio, we're going to talk about some motherfucking products and a goddamn service or three. It's gonna be great.
Okay.
You ready for this shit, Shireen?
I'm so fucking ready. Robert.
Roll these ads.
Italian Robert that I've just learned. Okay, I'm gonna shut up.
Pizza. That's...
Robert. Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's okay. It's okay to be racist towards Italians.
It was a Mario reference. I guess, is Mario racist?
Have been tied to Mario for too long.
Wait, Mario is so racist.
Yes, incredibly so. But it's fine.
I'm shattered. My little self that played Mario growing up is really sad.
Listeners, you couldn't see it, but the light went out of Shireen's eyes for a whole 30 seconds.
Jesus Christ. Let's go to ads. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. Wow, how have I been living like this? It's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless, when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Wow, how have I been affording this? It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/behind. That's mintmobile.com/behind. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/behind. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We've all got a lot going on right now, especially this year. A lot of stress, different stresses, big things, small things, medium things, family things, friend things, loved one things, just, you know, things. And when we keep those things bottled up, they can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a good way to get those things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. Therapy's helped me learn positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. And therapy can empower you to be, you know, a better or at least happier version of yourself. It's not just for people who have experienced trauma or who are dealing with something immediate and serious. It can just be a way to kind of perform maintenance on your own person. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/behind today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/behind.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We're back. All right.
I will say that I would play Yoshi a lot of the times in Mario Kart, not Mario. Yoshi was my guy. So,
have you gotten all the anti-Italian bigotry out of your system now, Shireen?
I didn't mean it, Robert. Italian Mamma Robert. Mia. Roberto. Shut up. Sorry, I'm digging my own grave.
I do, like, you should have known I was Italian by, like, the frequency with which I gesture with my hands.
You're allowed to say that, but I'm not, am I?
No, I think everyone is allowed to recognize that about Italian people.
Well, they say that about Middle Eastern people, too. We're an expressive bunch.
Italy's not super far from the Middle East. Like, it's just literally across, like, a stream from
we're cousins.
From that
we're
chunk
cousins.
Of the world. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a reason why we were every Arab related to my big fat Greek wedding. We're all the same. We're all that whole region. The Mediterranean is all the same.
We all show both our love and hatred with food. Mm-hmm.
Very true. Very true.
Yeah. So the month he turned 16, Gabriel's very first poem was published. It was an ode to King Umberto. Gabriel's father, Francesco Paolo, had it printed and handed out to townsfolk who showed up to take part in the king's birthday celebrations. And normally when someone's dad helps them publish their work, it's a sure sign that that work is no good. But this was not the case with Gabriel. Less than a year later, his father helped him publish his first book of poetry called Primavera. Now, right out of the gate, it was clear that Gabriel D'Annunzio was an incredible poet. He sent copies of his book out to several of the greatest Italian poets of the day, and most of them wrote him back with, like, very positive things to say about his work. And he's 17 at this point.
Wow.
A number of them even invited him into their homes and gave him advice and counsel. Critics raved about his work. The priests at his boarding school considered banning the book because it had powerfully erotic subject matter. It contained lines like, "With trembling agitation, I laid you on the water lilies and kissed you with convulsed lips, crying, 'You are mine.' Like a viper, you writhed and groaned." So, like, the priests are like, this is way too much fucking to allow in our religious school.
But that must have fueled his cause. That must have just been fuck yeah, this is what I wanted.
They didn't ban the book. They wanted to, but they decided that his use of Italian was so perfect and his verse form was so exquisite that they couldn't ban the book. It was just too well written.
Wow.
So, like, yeah, they decided to allow, because, like, but, like, fuck, the dude can write. Like, that's how good the poems
are. That's crazy. That is.
Yeah.
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 I mean, especially for the time, it must have been a very revolutionary thing to even write about.
Well, you know, they are Italians, so yeah, like this is like you're going, like, there's always been more of this kind of like acceptance of sort of like this
passion.
Yeah, it is a very Italian thing.
That's true.
And I can't, I'm not going to have a lot of quotes from his poems in here, just because, like, a big part of them is that he was such a good writer in the Italian language. Mm-hmm. So, like, the translations, you lose a lot, I think. But it's universally recognized that this guy is one of the greatest poets in Italian history.
Whoa.
And some people will say, including he would say, that he was the best Italian writer since Dante.
I love that you said including him.
Like, yeah, he was sure of that. Most modern, like, academics will say, no, he was one of a number of people, but he's at a very high level. Like, had a big impact on the language.
I just hate that he is so, I mean, it's fine to be confident and know your worth, but to say that you're the best writer since Dante, that's like such a, I don't know, that's fucking wild. But so he was never a victim, or he never suffered from criticism
of
nepotism. Like, he, even though he had such obvious nepotism in his life, like advances and privileges, no one ever saw that as any kind of issue.
I think his work is just so good that, like, people are like, well, fuck. Like, I mean, yeah, he definitely comes from money. His dad is able to help him, but, like, his work does seem to stand on its own.
Interesting. Okay. I'll give you that.
Like, most academics who write about him now, like, agree that he was a monster and a piece of shit, but pretty much everyone agrees he was really good at writing poems.
Imagine if Hitler was good at painting.
Yeah, it's weird. You get this mix of dictators like Saddam and Hitler who are, like, wannabe artists but suck at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get guys like Stalin. Like, Stalin was a poet in his youth and was a really well-regarded Georgian poet.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he gave it up after a while, but he was, like, considered to be very good and still is.
No, I'm obsessed with poetry. Poetry is so powerful, and I write poetry. I think there's such a power in using the written word, and it can garner so much attention and respect, especially back then, because there wasn't, like, the internet. But it's a fascinating thing to, in this case, to, you have to separate the art from the artist. And we go through it right now with filmmaking. Like, someone makes a great film, then you find out they're a pedophile. So it's like, it's this balance of, like, someone can make something so profound and so incredible, but also be a complete waste of space or, like, piece of shit. So it's still going on now. And I think it's just fascinating to see it back then as well with poetry. I don't know.
Yeah, and you have to understand what poetry was back then too, because, like, now there are people like poems. Most everybody has at least a couple of poems that they've enjoyed, but it's not like a huge thing at the center of life for us back then. Like, to be honest, at least the feeling I get is that, like, poets at this period, particularly in Europe, kind of occupy the space culturally that, like, an Instagram or a YouTube star like occupies now. Like, they have these legions of utterly devoted fans, or like a pop star. Like, they are like the closest you can, like, the best poets of the day, guys like Byron, like the closest modern like comparisons would be someone like Beyonce. Like, that's the level of devotion that their fans have to them.
It was like that in the Middle East too. There's this poet kind of from similar roots. Like, he came from privilege. He was rich. His name is Nizar Kabani. He's an amazing poet in the Middle East. He's Syrian from Damascus, and he was regarded as, like, a celebrity. His book was, like, banned from so many places because it was very erotic, very sexual, and it was, like, everyone would read it as, like, a political pamphlet that came out, like, it was thing that everyone was looking forward to. Like, it was this. It's poetry was, like, the mouthpiece of that generation for a long time. And he would use it in a political way and to talk about, like, I don't know. I think poetry now is not what it was back then. And because the time is so different, but no, it's, I believe you. They were celebrities.
Yeah. And so, like, when I talk about poets in this episode, think about, like, a very high level pop star.
Mm-hmm.
When you're thinking about, like, the way people treat these guys. So he starts reaching out to the most famous poets in Italy with his work, and they love it. And one of them who is particularly taken is a fellow named Nencioni, who's one of the biggest poets in Italy at the time. And Nencioni takes him under his wing and starts like tutoring him, and he introduces him to a book by a guy named Thomas Carlyle. The book is On Heroes, and it's basically the thesis statement of the great man theory of history, that like single exceptional individuals are the ones who move history, not economic forces or like the actions of like mass groups of people. Exceptional individuals are what make history. And Gabriel is absolutely taken with this theory, and is, of course, convinced that he is supposed to be one of those great men.
Mm-hmm.
And from a very early age, it was not just enough. He's not just one of these people who like wants to make a living with poetry or like just has to express something. The thought of being anything but like the very best poet writing in Italy is like hateful to him.
Mm-hmm.
So early in their relationship, he sends Nencioni a book of his poetry with a letter asking if his work is just charming or pleasing. Because if that's the case, he was going to give up writing immediately. He said that little artists and little poets were abhorrent to him. And asks, can I cover myself in glory? Again, he can't stand the thought of just being a good poet. Like, that's not enough for this guy. He's got to be the best.
Okay.
By age 18, Gabriel had published 3 books of poetry. One was dedicated to his recently deceased grandmother. The other was a second edition of his first book, Primavera, with 43 new poems and revisions to his old work. His father paid the publishing costs for all these books, but D'Annunzio took responsibility for picking the font, the paper, the printer, and in setting up distribution deals with bookstores. Both D'Annunzios had a hand in promoting the work, and the differing ways they went about it say a lot about their personalities. Francisco Paolo, like a normal person, threw a big banquet party in the middle of town to drum up interest in the book. Gabriel, being a narcissistic maniac, sent an anonymous letter to the editor of a poetry magazine in Florence, lamenting that Gabriel D'Annunzio, the young poet already noted in the Republic of Letters, in his words, had died after falling off of a horse.
What?
So he sends a letter to like a big poetry critic and claims that like, hey, this guy Gabriel who wrote this book, he's dead now.
Holy shit!
Well, he does this because guys like Shelley and Byron, poets who died very young after publishing, you know, a handful of books, were like the biggest poets in Europe at the time. They had these huge cults of fans because they died young.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knows that like if it's just the story of like a young poet who's pretty good and has published a new book of poetry, like he'll sell some copies, people will talk about it, but it's not going to be a huge deal. But if he's a great poet who dies tragically young, that's a huge deal. Wow. And it gets treated that way by the editor. Like a bunch of magazines start writing articles about this dead young poet. They like call him things like the last born of the muses. Like he suddenly, the fact that he's believed to have died young elevates his work instantly in Italy. And he develops this huge culty fan base. And eventually Gabriel corrects the error and basically plays it off as if, oh, this must have been, someone must have just gotten their wires crossed and like sent you incorrect information. And you know, it's the 1880s. Like,
honestly,
happens.
I respect this. This is genius level. This is genius level influencer. Like, I don't know. That's one way to get a following back in the day. There was no Instagram. You couldn't just, you know what I mean? Like you fake your death.
Yeah. Yeah, he fakes his death, and it turns what would have been kind of a modestly successful book of poems into a national news story. So as he turns 18, Gabriel D'Annunzio is already famous and already like very well regarded.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he was already fucking. As a young teen, his teachers had noticed that on walks through town, Gabriel constantly stared at young women. At age 14, he spent a few days in Florence with a family friend and wound up taking that guy's 17-year-old daughter to the Museum of Archaeology and making out with her in public. Shortly thereafter, on a school trip to another town, he pawned his grandfather's gold watch to pay for a hooker so he could lose his virginity.
Okay.
Now, yeah, he just dives right into fucking. You cannot stop this guy from fucking, which gets exactly as rapey as that sentence should make it seem.
Yeah.
Yeah. The summer after he was finally allowed to go back to Pescara, at age 16, he flirted constantly with every woman in town. He found himself particularly enamored with a young peasant girl. She, unfortunately, was not enamored with him, so he hunted her down, chased her into a vineyard, shoved her to the ground, and raped her. Gabrielle was quite proud of this and wrote about it openly. He had a lifelong obsession with raping poor women, particularly servant girls. And it's actually hard to tell how often he did it because the act was such a fetish for him that he also fantasized about it regularly.
Okay, but, my this mouth is, a is thing he's wide into. The fuck open. I am... Because when you when you read that poetry verse like before the break, where she was like writhing and whatever, yeah. I was like in my brain I was like, that sounds rapey, and this makes so much sense in the worst way. I am disgusted that I agree with some of the points that you made earlier.
He's a very rapey guy.
Oh,
that
God.
Is a big part of his personality.
Oh God.
I mean, we're talking about the guy who invented fascism.
But that's the thing. You can be a ladies' man and not be rapey. Like, that's...
Absolutely.
A rapey ladies' man is the worst kind of ladies' man. That's the...
Well,
Oh, God.
There's a lot of class issues wrapped up in this. Because mm-hmm. he doesn't... At least, I'm not aware of him. I don't think he raped... upper class women, wealthy women, famous women. And he had hundreds of affairs with the most famous women of the era and was considered to be a very great like romancer.
Mm-hmm.
His particular fetish was in raping poor women.
That is just appalling. I mean, not really.
Fucked.
It's not appalling, it's just disgusting.
Yes.
Wow.
It's horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible. Because he's regarded as this womanizer, a seducer, and also this rape fantasy of poor people is just regarded as a fetish because he has all these other qualities.
But the thing is, though, it's a little more complicated than that. Not that it's morally complicated, it's horrible. But at the time, number one, most men who he would have talked about that, he wouldn't have hid the fact that he was forcing himself on these poor women, and they wouldn't have really thought it was bad. Like,
yeah.
That's kind of, like, it's a rapey time and place.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, Italy in this period. And, like, not just Italy, obviously, like, everywhere in the world.
Yeah, no, I mean, you rape and pillage. That was, like, how you were fucking taught to like, show yourself as a man. It's fine. Yeah.
We're not all the way past that now, obviously.
No.
So, it was worse back then. And he would not have, this was not, like, a dark secret of his, is mm-hmm. the point. Like, this is a thing that he was like, yeah, I'm a ladies' man. I romance these women. I force myself on these women. That's just what a ladies' man do. Like,
right,
that's,
yeah.
That's the attitude with which
he
presents himself.
I'm for all the classes,
world.
Even if they don't want me to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of especially if they don't want me to, actually.
Yeah. Oh,
at age 18, Gabrielle met Giselda, the daughter of a schoolmaster in Florence. When he first met her, she was sobbing because she'd just seen the corpse of a little girl who'd frozen to death. This really turned Gabrielle on. They started dating and fucking. In his early letters to her, he would write about how much the sight of her tears turned him on. I want to make those tears fall again. Lucy Hughes Hallett writes, quote, he luxuriated in the idea of her unhappiness. He even told her how much he would like to see her corpse. He loved it that she was deathly pale, like the Blessed Damozel, the dead girl of Rossetti's famous poem and painting, but he would have preferred her even paler. He told her that he would go around all the florists in the city, fill a carriage with assorted flowers, to come and bury her beneath them. Yes, to bury you. I want to make you die, he wrote to Tito Zucconi, not, as one might expect, promising to cherish and protect Tito's daughter, but announcing, I and Elda cannot live long. Both he and Giselda were, so far as we know, in perfectly good health, yet D'Annunzio wrote, our cold bodies will fall to the earth to feed the flowers, and we will be swept away, unconscious atoms, in the irresistible currents of the universal force.
I want you even paler. I want you dead.
Yeah, some red flags, huh?
Well, okay. Unfortunately, I dated someone that told me he thought it was attractive when I cried. And I think, like, it's such a weird thing to say to someone, yeah. like, to be like, I think girls are hot when they cry, or, like, I'm turned on by girls crying. There's an element of some, like, I mean, I guess there is a beauty to tears. I'm fucked up. I don't know. I think, like...
It's complicated. Like, you're not a bad person if, like, obviously, you're
but,
not a bad
okay,
person.
Sorry, I don't
want
to get into this. I have been,
like,
ghosting my therapist. I don't want to use you as a therapist. But, he's also a necrophiliac then? Like, he's also into, like, deadness?
You know, I don't know. I wouldn't say that, because I don't think that's... I think it's more that the art of... He's very much into classical and medieval art, and that sort of art, there's, like, this death obsession, because death mm-hmm. was such a part of the Middle Ages, and there's a lot of paintings and poems and works of about, like, focused around dead women.
Yeah.
Like, fucking Dante is obsessed with this dead chick that he only met twice. Like, it's... it's a thing. And so it like now if somebody's like fantasizing, yeah, I would say, yeah, that's probably what that dude's into. But
at the time it was probably just way, romanticizing this idea of I don't know, losing your life.
Romantic death. Yeah. Like there's so much culturally wrapped up in it that like you really honestly can't compare it to anything today. Mm-hmm. Cause like we don't have those same sort of, they're not nearly as powerful as they were then.
Wow.
Now, you know what won't fantasize about your dead body? That's a bad way to lead into ads.
An ad break. You'll never get raped by an ad break. Oh, God.
Yeah. You know what won't molest peasant girls in a field? Jesus.
I hope the ad that comes up is like, I don't know, fucking, what do you get sponsored by? Like dog
food? An ad for Gabriel D'Annunzio? Oh, boy. Okay. Let's just go to products.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
We're back.
I mean, the first ad break started with me being a bigoted racist against Mario, or like realizing that Mario is tainted forever. And the next one led it up to me. I'm sad.
Yeah, that's the D'Annunzio effect.
Okay, continue. I'm sorry. This is not about
over
me.
The 2 years that they were together, Gabriel wrote Giselda 500 letters. They actually spent very little time in each other's company. Shortly after hooking up, he graduated and wound up traveling all around Italy, launching his career as a writer. He continued to write her dizzyingly passionate love letters, but ignored all of her pleading requests to visit her in Florence. Sometimes he would even pass by the city on journeys to other places without diverting himself to visit this woman he claimed to love. The fact that he wasn't all that into seeing her didn't stop him from giving her orders on what to wear, only black. But by 1883, he was tired of the relationship, and gradually his letters to her dwindled off into nothing. Gabrielle was never able to actually break off things with anyone. He just sort of ghosted them after spending months and even years writing tens of thousands of passionate odes to their bodies. This would prove to be a lifelong habit for the poet and writer.
By his own count, Gabriel bedded around 1,000 women in his lifetime, and this is probably not far from accurate.
Damn.
He developed a reputation for being not just a great seducer of women, but for abandoning them and breaking their heart. His lovers would repeatedly attempt suicide, and a number of them probably succeeded. One of the reasons I really love Lucy Hughes Hallett's biography of Gabriel is that she's a woman, and she brings a woman's perspective to the way this guy dealt with his relationships. Mm-hmm. And I'm very interested in the way she writes about him, because she's very detailed and thorough, and clearly is an appreciator of his work, but is also utterly unsparing in sort of analyzing him as a human being. She writes at one point, quote, "The more unhappy a woman was, the more interesting to him she became. The more he tantalized Elda with promised visits, which were repeatedly deferred, the more adorable her image seemed to him. You must be sad, immensely sad, my poor angel," he wrote. "You will be thinking of me with desperate desire." The idea of her disappointment, denied his savage kisses, was one he liked to dwell on. Seeing her so seldom, she was really in no position to report on how pale and wan Elda really was. But he addressed her in a rapture of sadistic pity as, "My pallid Ophelia, my poor betrayed virgin." So he's like into ignoring and mistreating.
He's an emotional manipulator. Like, and
he's a fundamentally abusive person.
He's a very abusive, like emotionally abusive person. And ghosting someone, and like there's a term called love bombing, where you're like showering someone with all this affection and everything, and then you're just like gone. And it's a huge form of emotional manipulation, because you make them addicted to you, because every time, and it's like scientifically proven that whenever this person reaches out again, your cortisol goes up, and your cortisol is like your stress hormone, and it's like literally the same way an addict reacts to an addiction. So he's literally making all these women addicted to him, and it's conniving and disgustingly brilliant, because that's what a really good emotional abuser does.
One of the things that's really hard about thinking, like, at this point in my life, just because of the way my career and my travel has gone, like, most of my relationships have wound up being long distance for some particular point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a really, that's one of the things that's like really tough about them, is there is this like addictive sort of like nature to the relationship, where you're apart and then like you're together and you get this like massive oxytocin release. And then like it's hard not to, I don't know, like it's one of those things that I always wonder about, like, because it's difficult to do that and not like fuck it up and not hurt the other person or get hurt yourself. Like, both of those things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess they're hard.
Because when a relationship is established as this, like, I don't know, like, it's hard to describe it as anything but an addiction, because there's like this huge overwhelming release of happiness and everything when you're together, and then you're not, and then especially if there's someone that's constantly pulling the rug from under you or pulling away constantly, that only feeds the addiction for the other person. So in this case in particular, I think, I mean, like, in the relationship that I've kind of, like, the closest thing I've had to a real relationship was long distance, so I could kind of relate to what you're experiencing as far as, like, when you're apart, it's like you're just waiting to be with them again, and you're waiting for that, like, basically a hit, and then as soon as you get it, you're good. Even if they're just, like, replying to a message or whatever, it's like you're constantly needing that, like, streamline of, like, or, like, I don't know. But in his case, it's a one-side addiction. He's completely fine. I don't think he ever means anything he writes.
No.
Yeah.
He is not at all emotionally engaged, which is part of what makes it abusive, right? If you've got two people and you're both dealing with that thing and you're both emotionally into each other, that's not abusive. But if you, and number one, he also doesn't, in no way does this need to be a long distance relationship. He is very well off, mm-hmm. And successful from an early age, and absolutely could at least visit her mm-hmm. regularly. Like, there's times where he's like an hour away and he just doesn't give a fuck.
He probably gets turned on with having this kind of power.
Yes.
He knows he has power over these women, and he knows that his emotional abuse has made them addicted to him and his presence, even if, like, he's not there. And that probably turns him on more than any type of sex, in my opinion.
Like, he's absolutely sitting there jacking off as he writes about how sad he thinks she is. Like, that's what he's into here.
And that's why he's a sociopath, because fucked. You're just, wow.
In 1921, when Gabriel was very famous and renowned, not just in Italy, but all across Europe, Giselda wrote him and asked for permission to sell the letters that he'd sent her. She needed the money to give to her son so he could get married. Gabriel refused her this and instead asked her to hand over the letters to his lawyer. So, like, he just doesn't give a shit. Like, mm-hmm. he just stops writing this woman, like, and it completely cuts her off without even, like, talking to her about
wow.
it.
Wow.
Just one day, we're just done. Like, mm-hmm. and he doesn't even tell her we're done. She just stops getting letters and never hears from him again. So, like most great men in history, Gabriel treated the women, and indeed the men in his life, like trash. But this did nothing to halt the meteoric growth of his career. He went to Rome, where he studied literature, published more poems, and started writing books. In 1882, he wrote The Innocent, a book about a dandy and fuck-hungry man named Tullio Hermil, who cheats constantly on his saintly wife until she cheats on him and finally gets pregnant. In 1889, he published Il Piacere, considered the manifesto of Italian decadentismo, which is more or less what it sounds like. And I'm going to read you two paragraphs from Wikipedia's summary of this book.
Okay.
Gerard, an aristocrat, is in mourning over the death of his mistress, Leonora. He listens to tape recordings of them having sex and records his recollections of the day he met Leonora for the first time at the Carnival of Venice many years ago, on a day he felt sexually adventurous. In a flashback, we see him meet her on the street, introducing himself as Giacomo Casanova. After chasing her through the city, he finds her waiting for him behind a column in a passageway, where he lifts her dress and has sex with her. Later that day, in an opium den, after having a smoke, they are initiated by Hanani in the cosmic secrets of pleasure and join in a threesome with her. Back in the present, Gerard and Fiorella dress Leonora's naked body for her funeral. When Ursula and Edmund, Leonora's children from another man, arrive for the funeral, Gerard, who has not seen either of them for 10 years, at first mistakes Ursula for Leonora. Gerard is now legal guardian to both until they come of age. In a sudden fit, Edmund cries out that his mother was only a whore and suffers an epileptic attack. He is calmed down by his sister breastfeeding him like their mother did. Later, it is Fiorella who repeatedly breastfeeds him and with whom he has his first sex. That's just two paragraphs. It goes on. Like, that's the kind of books this guy writes. Like, they're the smuttiest smut to ever.
I mean, I'm still not over the phrase fuck hungry that you used maybe 5 minutes ago.
He is very fuck hungry writing. Damn. Fundamentally fuck hungry is Gabriel D'Annunzio.
That is twisted.
Yeah, but they're wildly successful.
Like, I mean, because it's what's the word? It's yeah, pushing that
they're the
button,
horniest
you know?
Books
it's...
ever, and everyone's horny. Yeah.
Everyone's fuck hungry when you want it. When we're honest, everyone's fuck hungry. Yeah.
Everybody's fuck hungry, and Gabriel is just leaning into it. Like, you guys want horny books? I'll write the horniest fucking books anyone's ever
damn.
Written.
Yeah.
People are
I'll
sucking each other's milk
too,
and fucking each
nature.
Other. Fuck it.
Jesus.
Yeah, wow. It's just like the most depraved, decadent shit he can mm-hmm. think of.
Yeah, but for his legion of followers, they're probably like, this is for like from his real experience. Like, he probably did all this stuff because he's like this amazing womanizer.
I mean, he probably did a lot of this stuff, to be yeah. honest. Like, yeah, he was he didn't have a lot of boundaries.
Can I ask, like, was he a good looking guy?
I'm gonna show you his picture at the
How
end
did
of
he
this
get
episode,
away with it?
Shireen.
Oh my God.
We'll talk about that. He was not considered good looking, though.
Fuck.
Most of Gabriel's protagonists were aristocrats, though he himself was not. It's notable that his only marriage was to Maria di Galici, a duchess, and probably because marrying her technically made him an aristocrat, too. He had 3 children with her, and Christ knows how many with other random lovers. He never took care of any of these kids. And I'm going to quote from the New York Times. Wildly generous, he bestowed upon them custom-made gifts by Bucaleri and famous guys with flamboyant nicknames that bring to mind a pantheon of Olympic goddesses: Basilisa, Nike, Barbarella, and of course Core, the outrageous Marchesa Casati. Yeah, I don't know who any of these people are, but he's like he's always got these loving nicknames that are like really like out of this world flamboyant, and he spends thousands of dollars essentially on fancy gifts for whoever he's fucking before he abandons them.
It's love bombing.
Yeah. D'Annunzio was wildly successful and made fortunes from his writing, but he spent those fortunes even faster than he could accumulate them. I found a write-up on his life on The Rake, a fashion and style-focused magazine, that makes it clear just how he managed this. Quote, "He could shop until he didn't drop, endless trips to the tailor, thousands of books, and he once even acquired 22 dogs and 8 horses, all in one purchase. When he stayed in hotels, he always traveled with his own sheets. I am, as he once explained with characteristic self-assuredness, a better decorator and upholsterer than I am a poet or novelist. Indeed, at the turn of the century, when his marriage into aristocracy, along with his journalism and plays, afforded him considerable wealth, wealth. He habitually lived in rented furnished houses that, at great expense, he immediately refurbished in extravagant fashion. Or, as he put it, in a style gorgeous enough to be worthy of a Renaissance lord, which involved filling his properties with mock 16th century furniture of his own design. He's that guy.
I mean, I think that's really funny that he's like, I'm an even better upholsterer and decorator than I am a poet. Yeah. Like, you think I'm good at this? Well, God, I'm not bad at anything, basically. God.
Yes. The other people in Gabriel's life were more distractions to him than real human beings. At one point, when he already had 8 horses, he spent the money given to him specifically to feed his kids on buying a new horse. By 1893, he was 30 years old and living in Naples to avoid his creditors because he was just in huge debt all the time. He'd long since abandoned his wife and all 3 children, as well as Elvira Fraternali, a woman he lived with and loved for 8 years. He broke up with her to move in with a Sicilian princess. He was actually charged with adultery for this and almost went to jail for fucking this princess.
Wow, you can go to jail for fucking. If anyone should go to jail for fucking, it's him.
Yeah, yes, if anyone should, I'm not normally, as long as there's consent, well, actually, he should have gone to jail.
No, if anyone should go to jail for any kind of fucking, it's him.
Yeah, it's him. When writing novels and poetry wasn't enough to cover his debts, D'Annunzio wrote for tabloids and gossip rags. He used his media connections to do things like tip off gossip journalists about when and where he would publicly be breaking up with one of his lovers. He started telling fanciful lies that he'd been born aboard a boat, that he had a glass eye, that he had 2 bottom ribs removed so he could suck his own dick. Yes, Gabriel D'Annunzio is the origin of that.
Is he really?
Yeah, that's the first time I think we come across it. Yeah.
He is a shithead, but he did start so many things. Maybe the first ghoster.
You
maybe
don't even
the first
know all fucking, he started.
Oh my God, wow. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, he's definitely of the belief of like any press is good press. So
yes,
damn, that's just.
And his life kind of proves that that's true. I found a couple of articles comparing him to Donald Trump. And while he's a much more talented person than Trump, and did succeed on his own merits, that's not completely ludicrous, as we'll get to. Like, there's actually some comparisons between the two men. Now, Gabriel's maxim was, one must make one's life as one makes a work of art. As the Rake notes, he was, quote, a diehard disciple of Baldassare Castiglione, the author of a 16th century book, The Book of the Courtier, in which the writer posited what he referred to as the universal rule in all human affairs, sprezzatura, a facade of nonchalance that concealed the artistry required to pull off challenges with aplomb, regarded even at the time as both romantic and deceptive in almost equal measure. D'Annunzio clearly lived out Castiglione's doctrine, which was described disparagingly by Henry James as beauty at any price, beauty appealing alike to the sense and the mind. So, you would not, however, mistake Gabriel D'Annunzio for beautiful. By age 30, he was completely bald. He was short. He was, to his credit, very physically fit and muscular, but his teeth were disgusting, his breath was horrible, and his voice was high-pitched and considered weird by all who heard it. Liane de Puy, a famous Parisian courtesan, met him once on a visit to Florence. Here's how she described him. There before me was a frightful gnome with red-rimmed eyes and no eyelashes, no hair, greenish teeth, bad breath, the manners of a mountebank, and the reputation, nevertheless, for being a ladies' man.
You just described like a goblin, like a gremlin. Yeah.
This he's is a the fuck guy. Goblin, though.
This is the guy.
This is the guy that no one can't bone, except for the women he sexually.
How?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
I am livid. I don't know. I don't know why I'm so much more angrier than I would be if he was good looking, but I am. I'm so angry.
Yeah. Well, it's.
It's because in my brain, I rationalize like, if you're a ladies man and you're good looking, you can get away with it. Like, you can get away with so much shit behavior if you're a good looking person, man or woman or anything. If you're good looking, yeah, you get away with shit. It's like scientifically proven. You have an easier life, whatever. Yep. But if you, like, after you're a piece of shit and you like are repulsive by this description, like, Jesus,
it's remarkable. And I don't really understand
it. His teeth were rotten and his breath smelled. Why would you ever be?
I mean, to be honest, Shireen, a big part of it, just you have to understand, like, he's a great poet. Like, that's probably a lot of why is he's like, he's
so you
this
can be
kind
like a shithead, like,
that we almost can't,
like, maybe in this context
we almost
of
can't
the world
grasp
it's
it.
Like, you can be like a really talented musician, right? But
yeah,
you're maybe like,
you know,
gross.
It's like you hear stories about like some famous rock stars who like just didn't shower and were like these nasty like drug addicts, but like everybody, because like their music was really good, and there's just like something about that that can overcome an odious other aspects of your personality, you know?
I will say, talent and ambition are maybe, ambition in my opinion is probably the most attractive quality, but I just can't get over all the other things.
Yeah.
That description is a repulsive description of a human being. Like, that is...
I would say... Sorry, I
No, I'm just mad. Go ahead.
I mean, I would say you have to remember... One thing that kind of helps me is, look at pictures of, like, John Lennon with his shirt off, and remember that there was a time when everyone in the world basically wanted to fuck John Lennon.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, just take a look at that guy shirtless. Like... hard to get your head around it, but like it's because of the artistic, not just how his music on its own, but also the cultural like platform he stood on was so elevated.
We revere these artists. They're regarded as these really artistic, beautiful souls. Maybe not beautiful in Gabrielle's case.
Definitely,
but like,
not a beautiful soul
it's more,
in this case.
He's revered.
Or in John Lennon's case,
this...
he was abusive. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, are you going to show me a photo?
Oh, yeah, in a little
bit. Okay,
yeah.
Fine. So I'm so excited.
Despite his looks, Gabrielle managed to sleep with many of the most beautiful women in Europe, and the vast majority of the sex was consensual. His habitual rape seemed to be mostly of poorer women. His housekeeper was required to have sex with him 3 times a day, whether she wanted to or not. Gabrielle kept his homes bizarrely warm at tropical temperatures so he could wear only a light, thin kimono-style robe with the special hole in the fabric for his dick.
Oh, my fucking God.
He had custom shoes shaped like penises. You almost missed the penis
shoes. Wait, shoes that are shaped like penises? This gets more absurd by the fucking second. Are you shitting me?
I you know what? Maybe I haven't emphasized enough. He's Italian.
Does that explain the penis shoes? I'm sorry. Do you have penis shoes? Jesus.
Of course.
Oh, okay. Well,
when you're Italian at age 18, you get your penis shoes. That's just a part of being Italian.
The kimono,
the
whole,
word Italy
the penis
means
shoes.
An ancient Etruscan
like
land
clown.
Of penis shoes.
Wow.
Yeah, he does a little bit. Now, Gabrielle was above all else a genius at brand management. He knew how to make Gabrielle D'Annunzio into a star and to keep himself in the headlines. It was crucial to him that people believe him capable of literally anything. And so, in pursuit of that end, he ran for the Italian parliament in 1897 as an independent. He called himself the candidate for beauty and ran on a platform of pushing the politics of poetry. A big fan of Nietzsche, he declared that he was beyond right and left, as I am beyond good and evil. In a way, Gabrielle was kind of a prototype for Donald Trump, as well as Adolf Hitler, the first man to take his literary fame and pop culture cachet and turn it into political power. But when it came to actually staying in power, D'Annunzio decided he really hated politics. He served one term and never held any kind of legitimate public office again. So he is like the first guy to take, like, he's just a famous guy for being famous, mostly.
Yeah.
Like, he's a great poet, but like he's also really just famous for being a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And he turns that into political power. And that's really hasn't been done, you know,
like
in the way that he did it.
That is fascinating. Also, side note that I'm still thinking about the kimono. I'm sorry.
The dick kimono, the cock
well,
kimono.
Well, because if the temperatures are so high and that it keeps them this tropical level, I watched Curb Your Enthusiasm. I watched that for the first time recently. I'm all caught up. But there's this one episode with Leon, his roommate, fucking a hot yoga teacher. Apparently, warmer temperatures, according to this episode, good for orgasms. So maybe he was onto something.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Then again, I'm sorry, I'm a piece of shit. But continue.
And I will say, like, this was not like he was not like a one sided sort of lover. Like he was real into cunnilingus and wrote about it. For pages sometimes.
He says
he
mostly consensual.
Be, right?
It's most of the people that had
mostly
sex with
consensual.
Him wanted to have sex with him. So
yep.
But yeah, I mean, like, would you say that his use of like his brand of narcissistic politics, like using his platform to become a politician, like was that not what like Reagan did Reagan, sorry, did I say I always mispronounce it because I say it how I think it's pronounced. English is my second language, leave me alone.
Like Reagan, like since D'Annunzio, a lot of people have done that, but he's kind of
but
like
he was the first,
he's the first.
Wow. Who's just really mostly famous for his fame, and then turns that into a political career. And this is not the end of his political career, just his end as an elected political leader.
Oh.
So keep that in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. We haven't even stepped foot into the fascism yet.
Jesus. So much about this guy. His debts were so outrageous by 1910 that D'Annunzio was forced to flee Italy for Paris, where he made a film, collaborated with some of the greatest artists of the day, and became friends with Proust. American whiskey heiress Natalie Barney wrote about this time, quote, "He was the rage. A woman who had not slept with him made herself ridiculed. He even managed to bed Romaine Brooks, a famous lesbian artist who wound up painting his portrait." So, like, again, you really can't, it's hard to understand, like, the level of fame to where, like, a famous lesbian would be like, yeah, I gotta fuck him. Like, I just gotta see what's going on there.
That's crazy.
It's wild. As the years in Paris
ticked off. What?
Yes, actually, you'll see it. You'll get a sense for the size. Yeah, it's in, like, a banana hammock in the picture I'm gonna show you. And it's not small. I'll say that.
Okay.
As the years in Paris ticked along, Gabriel found himself less and less enthralled with high society and more obsessed with the war clouds on the horizon. The actual start of World War I came as a surprise to most, but for years prior to the war, every observant person in Europe had been aware that some sort of violent conflict was very nearly, like, coming. Artists who recognized this wound up in one of two camps. Many dreaded it and worked to do all they could to pull Europe back from the precipice. Gabriel, however, wound up in another camp. He saw it as his duty, as a lover of beauty, to push Europe into calamity. This seems insane to us now, and it is fucking crazy, but D'Annunzio was not alone in this. I'm going to read again from Lucy Hughes Howlett's biography. Quote, "In the political rhetoric and poetry of the period, civilian existence is gray, dim, morally compromised, and physically grubby. The battlefield, by contrast, is bright, a glitter with weapons and flashing with joy. Above all, it is clean. When Britain declared war, Rupert Brooke proclaimed his gladness to leave the sick hearts that honor could not move, and half-men and their dirty songs and dreary." Like D'Annunzio, Brooke saw the war as a saving freshness into which he could plunge as swimmers into cleanness leaping. In Germany, Thomas Mann welcomed the conflict as a purging and a liberation. "Let the storm come," cried the Hungarian Doso, I'm not even going to try to pronounce this guy's last name, "and sweep out our salons." So, like, there's this idea that, like, society is decadent. There's all these, like, young, like, lazy, like children of privilege sitting around drinking coffee and talking about politics. We need a war to kill a bunch of them and make the others into better people.
Mm-hmm.
Clean out these crowded cities. That's, like, a sizable chunk of particularly, like, the intelligentsia in this period is right into this idea.
Yeah, they're all Thanos.
They kind of are. Gabriel D'Annunzio had become a fervent nationalist by this point, an adherent of a school of Italian thought that believed the new nation needed to reabsorb or conquer a number of states that were currently its neighbors, but historically they believed Italian. This included much of what became Yugoslavia. But Gabriel didn't just see the coming war as a chance for Italy to gain lost territory. He saw it as a beautiful aesthetic endeavor in its own right. He believed that, quote, "a great conflict of the races would purge society of its weak elements." As soon as the guns started pounding in 1914, while Gabriel was still living in France, he had a friend drive him as close to the front lines as he could possibly get. They wound up in a place called Reims, where German artillery had just destroyed an ancient and famous cathedral. Taking a valet and several suitcases full of clothing with him, of course, Gabriel wound up in the middle of the front line, watching artillery land just a few hundred meters ahead of him and seeing the corpses of men and animals rotting in the mud. He immediately grabbed souvenirs and started taking fastidious notes. He used these notes to write an article about the German vandalism of the Reims Cathedral. He hadn't actually watched the cathedral's destruction, but he had no problem lying and describing how, with his own eyes, he'd watched them burn it. Gabriel D'Annunzio despised Germans, considering them a barbaric and disgusting race. The goal of his article was to try and push his nation into joining with France and Great Britain in the war. Now, Italy had entered World War I as an ally of Germany, but no one in the country was particularly interested in actually entering the war on Germany's side. In fact, most of the country wanted to stay out of the war entirely. Given how World War I went, this was not a bad call. But Gabriel wanted Italy to go to war more than he'd ever wanted anything in his entire life, and he set at once to the task of dragging his country with him. As soon as he got back from Italy, in mid-1915, he began giving speeches. And I'm going to quote from an article in the New Republic about this. Quote, Italy was no longer a pension di famiglia, a museum, but a living nation, he declared in one interventionalist demagogic speech to general acclaim. The prospect of mass deaths thrilled him. Benedetto Croce was repelled by his seeming to enjoy war, even to enjoy slaughter, as Hughes Hallett puts it. The politics of beauty was revealing itself as a politics of blood. Among his ardent supporters were Marinetti's futurists, who had recognized early on that, for all his fondness for classical art and medieval knickknacks, D'Annunzio was a fellow modern, a poet who rhapsodized over warships and steelworks, and who set a higher value on energy than he did on virtue. Genoa is where he first started haranguing the masses towards apocalypse. In his first 4 days there, he spoke 7 times. The Italian government itself was torn over the question of war. The Queen Mother desired it dearly, but most of the elected leaders were firmly against the idea. They hated that D'Annunzio was ranting about the need to destroy Germany while they carried on secret negotiations to try to plot the national course. Standing on balconies and shouting to increasingly large crowds, he urged his countrymen to pull out of the Triple Alliance and join the Entente with France, Britain, and Russia. He was not content just to attack Germany and make the case for war. Gabriel D'Annunzio made a habit of viciously attacking any politician who spoke out against his whims. He called them cowards and appeasers, the enemies within. He said the old order reeks and must be utterly destroyed. Sweep away all the filth, into the sewer with all that is vile. He called the current political order infected, diseased, corrupt, and defiled, and he said the only solution was cauterization. The corruption must be burned out. Gabriel called repeatedly for a holocaust to cleanse the body politic. Holocaust was, in fact, one of his most frequently used words, and in a positive sense. Foreign reporters who watched him were almost as enraptured as the crowds. Jean Carrère, a French reporter, wrote, "Never have I seen an orator advance before the public with such composure. Standing on his improvised tribune, he was magnificently alone, of a marble pallor, with two eyes aflame." And when Gabriel spoke to crowds, they didn't just listen, they acted. In May 1915, he made it to Rome and gave what would become one of his most infamous tirades. And I'm going to quote from Lucy Hughes Hallett again. He attacked the advocates of peace in vitriolic terms. The very air of Rome stank with their treachery. Those who still hung back from war were traitors, assassins of the patria, Italy's executioners. Giolitti, one of these politicians he hated, was strangling the nation with a Prussian rope. D'Annunzio was openly advocating violent attacks on the people's elected representatives. He called upon the Roman mob to take the law into their own hands. He urged his listeners to attack the appeasers who lick the boots on sweaty Prussian feet. He called for stonings and arson. His rhetoric was becoming ever more frenzied. "I tell you, there is treason here in Rome. We are being sold like a herd of diseased cattle." He urged the people to hunt down anti-war deputies. "Form squads." Squadro was one of the many words the fascists would pick up from him. "Lie in wait, seize them, capture them." An observer reports that the applause when he paused was like a storm. When he resumed to denounce Giolitti in ever more vituperative terms, that diabolical old blubber-lipped hangman, the storm was transformed into a cyclone. D'Annunzio was high on his own eloquence, on the frenzy of the crowds he flattered and inflamed, and on the prospect of blood. 52 years old, he extolled the ruthless purity of youth. A poet whose life's work had been the threading together of obscure and beautiful words, he inveighed against verbiage and called for action, swift, cruel if need be, and unambiguous. "It is not the time for speaking, but for doing." He ended by leading the crowd in an anthem, beating time with his little white hands while the people below bellowed out the refrain, "Let us join the cohort. We are ready to die. Italy has called."
Damn.
Yeah.
Fame is terrifying.
You're seeing some of the fascism creep in here, huh?
Yeah. I mean, fame is terrifying, and he obviously used this, like, visceral quality of his writing into his speeches, obviously. Like, he's a good wordsmith. Like, that's been already proven. But, like,
effective.
It's so terrifying when someone is already so, I don't know, praised and lauded for being this amazing thinker. He's obviously going to have a huge legion of people follow him in anything he does, even if it's to tell people to pick up a weapon and be violent. And the fact that Holocaust was a word that he used so much, like, that's so telling of, like, the kind of mentality he had. Even if he did despise Germany, like, he definitely had similarities to Hitler in that regard of, like, rallying people together and being an amazing speech person, like a speech giver. It's so disturbing, because I think that's a huge reason why fame and influence really freaks me out, is because you have all these people follow you blindly, just like with Trump. Trump has the same thing. I hate the people in the rallies that I see. I hate the people behind Trump that are clapping at every dumb bullshit thing he says. I hate them more than I hate Trump, honestly, because they're just sheep. I don't know.
You know, I
actually no. I don't want to say sheep. Sorry.
I think people
are intelligent, but they're also desperate to belong. And if someone is just like rallying people together for a cause that he thinks is like will better humanity, I don't know.
I think what you're getting at, and I think the reality both of why D'Annunzio was successful and why Trump is that everyone has this very deep understanding in our society, as they did then, that like something's wrong. Mm-hmm. Things shouldn't be as fucked up and hard as they are. Like this shouldn't be as messed up as it is. Someone is responsible. And if you are able to tell people who is responsible and convince them of who it is, and then inveigh upon that group or that person with the kind of rage that everyone has in their heart, mm-hmm. Whether or not it's directed, everyone has that anger in our society because we all know shit's fucked up. If you can convince people that you found the people who have fucked up the shit and then express the hatred that is in their hearts, you can get them to do anything. And that's all that matters. They don't care about laws. They don't care about precedent. They don't care about history. Yeah. They don't even care about their own health to a certain extent. If you are able to convince them of the group that's responsible for their pain and express the hatred that's in their heart towards that group. And that's what D'Annunzio's good at. That's what Hitler's good at. That's what Trump's good at.
You described what I was trying to articulate in a much better way. Because that's what's terrifying, is that what you said, you can get them to do anything. Because that's completely what happens.
And it works on all of us.
Yeah.
It works. I mean, to be honest, like a lot of the success of this podcast, which has been very successful and has done a lot for my career and has built up a fan base that's very like loyal and active, is because what we focus on is talking about like these are the assholes responsible for why shit is so fucked up,
right?
Like the most powerful thing in the world is harnessing the anger that exists in all of us because of the damaged nature of our society and directing it. It's not an inherently harmful, but Bernie Sanders' appeal is a lot in his ability to say, this is why shit's fucked up. This is who you should be angry at. We need to fix. Now, he does it in a non-toxic way, in a productive way. It doesn't have to be a horrible thing because the anger is real. And the anger that Trump's fans feel, the rage, they're not directing it in the right direction, but that rage is utterly earned in most cases.
No, I completely agree. I think directing that anger is such a powerful tool and being able to harness that is a terrifying quality when you use it in the wrong way, which is what Hitler did, which is what D'Annunzio is doing or did, and it's what
I'm going to do in my new cult. So stay tuned. Very excited. We're going to buy a compound. It's going to be like
just
that Wild
Wild
Country documentary.
With machetes, Battle Royale.
Machetes as far as the eye can see. Yeah. It's going to be glorious. Now, on multiple occasions, crowds rioted after D'Annunzio's speeches. Several times, they attempted to break into the prime minister's home in order to murder him. The violence only encouraged D'Annunzio further, and he repeatedly urged good citizens to take vengeance on lying politicians. If blood flows, such blood will be as blessed as that in the trenches, he said, drawing a direct line between political murder and the national war effort. Shortly after that speech, some of his supporters stole a fire truck and used its ladder to try to break into the home of one of his political opponents. Lucy Hughes Hallett writes, he was fast developing a brilliantly manipulative oratorical technique. He allowed his public no break in his contrivances of their hysteria. He played on them with rhetorical tricks borrowed from religious liturgy or from classical drama. Hear me, he cried. Listen to me. Understand me. The crowd was urged to join him, howling out responses to insistent evivas. These were not speeches to be rationally appraised, but acts of collective self-hypnosis. D'Annunzio's work as a dramatist had frequently been grandiose in conception, spectacular in their staging, and appalling for the violence of their sentiments. But never before had he produced anything like the shows he put on that radiant May. The sheer rage he worked these crowds into eventually made any outcome but war basically impossible. Most of D'Annunzio's enemies fled the city. The prime minister stepped down. Historian Mark Thompson calls what D'Annunzio achieved a coup d'etat in all but name. The leader of the Socialist Party, Filippo Turati, ruefully and accurately exclaimed, "Let the bourgeoisie have its war. There will be no winners. Everyone will lose."
Well...
On May 23rd, 11 days after Gabriel D'Annunzio entered Rome, Italy declared war on Austria-Hungary. There is, of course, significant debate over whether or not Italy would have entered the war on this side without D'Annunzio. Historians will note that the Pact of London, which set out Italy's new alliance, had been under negotiation for a while by the time he arrived in Italy. But most historians agree he had at least a very significant impact in pushing his country into World War I.
By the end of that war, more than 460,000 Italians would be dead. More than 955,000 would be wounded. The old order of Europe died, and Gabriel D'Annunzio helped to kill that too. His career, though, was just getting started. And now, Shireen, Sophie, would you scroll to the bottom of the script and show Shireen?
I don't want to.
Oh, no.
Oh, but you have to. She has to see D'Annunzio. Mm. This is the best.
I'm
so sorry, Shireen.
I just don't know. Let's just get a Band-Aid. Let's rip it off. Let's see it. Come on.
Okay, bro. Here he is. Here you go, Shushu. She just grabbed my computer.
What the fuck? Are you shitting me? Okay, first of all, banana hammock, hilarious. He does look like he is packing heat, but...
He is packing heat, yeah.
But
he's pretty stacked. He's pretty yoked.
He's just skinny. What do you mean?
Yeah, he's not yoked.
He's not yoked. He's just tiny.
He's got. Well, you gotta admit. You gotta remember too. Like people didn't know how to build muscle then the way they do now. Like he's pretty.
I mean, yeah, he doesn't have fat on him. I'll give him that. But yeah. He's also like, if anyone that's listening to this in the beginning was imagining this like attractive, womanizing, seducing, whatever, this is not the guy. But he did it.
No.
I mean, like, a champion for short guys, unfortunately, for y'all. But, you already have Napoleon. What more do you want? I don't know. Jesus, that's a hilarious photo, by the way. This photo is
amazing.
He's completely naked other than this banana thong. And his arms are at his hips, posed for this photo. His mustache is curled up. Didn't know he had a mustache, by the way.
Bald with a curled up mustache. You gotta see the picture.
He's a clown.
He looks like if Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, and Colonel Sanders had a baby, and that baby was a creep.
Yeah, I would
he's
say
the definition of creep. And if you look up creep, that's what I imagine.
If you watch the TV show Community, he looks like Pierce's father. Like he's that exact build and size. He's just this like weird little bald.
He's a little
man.
He's Smeagol.
Yeah.
Convinced his country to enter the dumbest
Smeagol
war in history.
Humanized, personified, whatever.
Yeah. He's Gollum. Oh. He does look a lot like Smeagol. Yeah.
Gollum, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. How you feeling after part one, Shireen?
I've learned a lot. I think we had a good like bonding time, you and I, to be honest. I feel like we just therapized each other a bit in parts of this episode, which I feel kind of like nice about. I think we're good friends now.
The D'Annunzio effect.
Oh God, don't give him credit. Give him more
You're feeling
credit.
His power, Shireen.
I would like credit for the friendship.
Thank you, Sophie. I will give you the credit.
I mean, this episode has convinced me, among other things, to buy a banana hammock. That seems like a good decision.
This episode has convinced me, among other things, that you should not have children. But, sorry, I'm kidding. If you would be a great dad, in all seriousness. Just don't give your children
machetes. That seems like a long reach to make, Shireen.
No, I've learned a lot. I can't wait to learn more and really...
Yeah.
Just the turn of this guy's life. What an eventful, awful... way to leave the world.
He's not lazy. You got to say that for the man.
He accomplished a lot. A very productive, like, is, back in the he, day.
We're not even.
I mean, we have that saying now, like, yet. You have as many hours in the day as Beyonce does. Back in the day, you have as many hours in the day as D'Annunzio has. You know what I mean? What country have you demolished today?
What world order have you destroyed?
Exactly.
What generation have you sent into machine gun nests?
Robert, do you think we can get a banana hammock sponsorship? That's just my only.
Oh, I hope so. I want a banana hammock sponsorship, and I would love it if we could get a war to sponsor us too. Like that would be really good.
Mm-hmm.
Like I feel like there's a lot of really good wars going on right now, and one of them should sponsor this podcast.
I mean, Lord knows they have the money. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Well, Shireen, you want to plug your pluggables?
Oh, yeah. I'm Shireen, and I am a co-host of a podcast called Ethnically Ambiguous. It's on the iHeartRadio Network. It's ethnically, you should look it up. It's everywhere you find your podcast. I am Shiro Hero, SHEEROHERO on Instagram, and Shiro Hero 666 on Twitter. And That's about it. I have a poetry book. If you guys want to like the poetry talk, it's on Amazon.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
I'm working on my next one.
But read Shireen's poetry.
It's really
inflate
depressing.
Her ego. Turn her into a monstrous sociopath who leads the world into a tremendous calamity.
Honestly, I'm just waiting to sell out. So please, yeah. Let's make this a reality.
Oh, we all are.
Just,
we all are.
I'm begging. I would love to sell out. So make it happen.
And I'm Robert Evans. You can find me on Twitter at IWriteOkay. You can find this podcast on the internet at BehindTheBastards.com, where you can find sources and this picture of D'Annunzio in his banana hammock. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @BastardsPod. And you can find me fully embracing the lessons of Gabriel D'Annunzio when I create my cult and plunge the world into a new dark age. So, like, look forward to that. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a real good time. Free machetes for all. Yeah, that's the episode. Have a good one, y'all.
Bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.